Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, May 25th, 2014. I'm Christina Karnatz.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. KUAF is supported by Pack Rat Outdoor Center, hosting Pint Night on Wednesday, June 18th from 5:30 until 8 p.m. at 209 West Sunbridge in Fayetteville. Refreshments and beer sales will benefit the Arkansas Canoe Club. More information is available on the web at packratoc.com.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large, the Wrecking Ball takes to downtown Springdale for a one-of-a-kind event for one night only. Plus, First Christian Church in Fayetteville prepares to celebrate 100 years later this morning.
But first, in previous years, a hodgepodge of criteria was used to judge how well high schools were doing at graduating students. But a recently published analysis of high school graduation rates in Arkansas uses a common set of guidelines for grading schools, giving researchers a first comprehensive look at which schools are doing the best job of retaining students through graduation. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more.
The Office for Education Policy in the University of Arkansas's College for Education and Health Professions conducts many studies. Jennifer Ash is the managing director of the office.
The Office for Education Policy, we are a research office within the University of Arkansas, and we are here to serve as a resource to state lawmakers, superintendents, principals, basically education stakeholders in the state of Arkansas. We publish data sets that people are able to look at of Arkansas school test score performance. We publish reports and policy briefs on different topical issues about education in Arkansas.
Gary Ritter, a professor at the U of A and director of the Office for Education Policy, says that when the office was founded about a decade ago, its initial goal was to inject evidence into policy discussions regarding K-12 education.
So we used multiple vehicles to try and bring evidence into the conversation, whether it be a policy brief, a more detailed Arkansas education report, a blog post, trying to talk to folks who interview us, give testimony at the legislature. Our goal is to sort through the evidence and try and make it understandable to policymakers who don't have the luxury of the free time to dig through evidence like we do.
One of the more recent issues that the Office for Education Policy has been digging into is graduation rates of high schools across the state.
This is the first, as far as we can tell, statewide report of high school graduation rates across the state of Arkansas since Arkansas and other states across the country have essentially agreed to use a roughly uniform and accurate and meaningful measure of graduation rate for high school students.
Ritter says that in years past, school districts throughout Arkansas and across the country used their own idiosyncratic methods for measuring graduation rates, so it was hard to make accurate comparisons between schools.
Some actually measured graduation rate by the fraction of 12th graders who made it through and graduated, which is essentially a useless graduation rate, right? Because many of the dropouts occur well before 12th grade, and most kids who make it all the way to the first day of 12th grade are not going to stop. They're going to make it through. So that's not a strong measure. The measure that we're using here and that all states across the country use is essentially a cohort measure. We look at the students who enter in ninth grade, and we ask what fraction of those make it through and graduate at the end of 12th grade within 4 years.
Ritter says that in years past, school districts throughout Arkansas and across the country used their own idiosyncratic methods for measuring graduation rates, so it was hard to make accurate comparisons between schools.
So we took the state's rates and organized it in a way that was understandable. So we didn't do anything all that interesting to come up with the rates. What we did do that was interesting was do some analysis to figure out which types of schools were doing the best job of graduating their students. And we also looked at which types of schools graduated particular kinds of students. So we didn't just look at overall graduation rates. We looked at graduation rates for traditionally underserved students, students who are disadvantaged, who face more challenges on the way to graduation. So we identified not only schools with high overall graduation rates, but schools with very high graduation rates for its neediest students.
Jennifer Ash says that one of the surprises that they found in compiling the analysis is that smaller schools tend to have higher graduation rates.
We're seeing Elkins and Farmington among the bigger ones that we would recognize, but also in the Northwest region in general, we saw much smaller districts.
So Elkins was a surprising one. We didn't see Elkins right. on the top of the board when it comes to test scores, yet they were graduating upwards of 95% of their kids within a four-year period, which is a very high rate. Just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, the statewide graduation rate is roughly 82 to 84%.
The reality of small schools having high graduation rates isn't something Ash or Ritter often see when just looking at test scores.
With test scores in Arkansas, often the larger schools have the great variety of AP courses, the great set of resources to offer students, and indeed have higher test scores at the end of the year in across this state. The larger schools, the Bentonvilles, the Fayettevilles, the Rogers, even larger schools in Little Rock, have very high test scores. Among our top schools with respect to graduation rates, we did not find those schools. So in Northwest Arkansas, we weren't seeing Bentonville and Fayetteville and Rogers at the top with graduation rates.
Ritter says that because of the disparity of resources between large and smaller schools, it does seem counterintuitive on the surface that small schools would be graduating more students.
But there are areas, I think, where larger schools fall short, and our findings are, in fact, consistent with a national report that Jen Ash came across just the other day.
So a report just came out from the America's Promise Alliance, and they were surveying students to find out what would lead to dropouts. And one of the things that they found was that students that didn't feel connected at all to the school were more likely to drop out. So if they didn't feel like they had peers or teachers or a counselor or someone who would notice that they were missing, they were more at risk to drop out of school. So that kind of maybe fits with our small school finding. It's possible that this is just a smaller environment, that you're gone through school with a smaller cohort of people. Everyone knows your name. Everyone knows who you are. And so you're more likely to stick it out.
Aside from the correlation between smaller schools and greater graduation rates, the report also showed that different regions in the state were doing better at graduating students than others.
The highest achieving regions in terms of test scores we continually find are Northwest Arkansas and Central Arkansas. Mm-hmm. However, in terms of graduation rates, we saw the Southwest section of the state was doing great in terms of graduation rates. And perhaps not coincidentally, the Southwest region of the state has slightly lesser poverty than the Southeastern region of the state mm-hmm. and smaller schools than the rest of the state.
And like many of the reports that come from the Office for Education Policy, Ritter says that the statewide graduation rate analysis isn't overly concerned with what the state is doing for economically advantaged students.
It's what we do for disadvantaged students who might have lots more challenges that really tells us how effective a school is doing its job. And we also think that these reports, they don't tell you what to do, but it certainly tells you that we don't want to throw up our hands and say, oh gosh, it's just too hard. All of the challenges poor students face, economically disadvantaged students face on the way to school, challenges involving two parents working, having no time to help with homework, all of these things exist across the state. And yet some of these schools and high schools and school districts are doing a wonderful job with all of their students and specifically with their traditionally underserved students.
Ritter says that schools like Grace Hill and Rogers and the Kip Delta Public Charter School in Helena are examples of schools doing a good job of serving traditionally underserved or disadvantaged student populations. To find out more about the statewide analysis on how well high schools are doing on graduating their students, visit officeforeducationpolicy.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks, based in Fayetteville, has installed a large solar array. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the Alternative Energy Project is part of an ambitious U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs green initiative.
At first glance, the large southeast parking lot at Fayetteville's historic VA hospital adjacent to the administration complex appears to have a series of new canopies, but in fact it's a massive new solar array. VA project engineer Lee Warren.
We're trying to save energy on campus, and then also we're trying to move some of our energy over to renewable approach to it.
The VA solar installation is part of a national VA project to reduce energy consumption. Warren stands beneath one of three solar arrays, which also serve as a carport cover over the 170-space parking lot. Each array is held aloft by massive steel horizontal crossbeams bolted to four vertical pedestals, and they all face upward slightly west.
Oh, it's around 12 degrees. That was part of the study as far as that goes. It was a design build, and as part of the design, you know, they determined what will be the best angle for this location.
The three arrays are 37 feet wide, but range in length from 116 feet to 309 feet. 1,218 square foot solar modules create 23,500 square feet of solar sink. The panels were installed on the parking lot because it was the least intrusive and most sunny spot on the 50-acre campus, even on this chilly mid-May cloudy morning.
It'll be some generation, yes, right now. Low temperatures really don't hurt us as much. In the winter, it's the angle of the sun that cuts down a little bit on it, but the cool weather, the cells work quite well. They actually prefer the cool weather.
But on sunny days...
This has a maximum generation of 266 kW. Overall, it's going to end up for the whole year of giving us about 4% of our usage on campus.
To power the hospital, clinics, and offices, a remote electrical pad northeast of the solar panels contained the inverter electrical equipment and associated controls. The system went online in February after a year of construction.
Oh, I thought it was a good opportunity for us to kind of be on the leading edge and look at some larger solar projects. In Northwest Arkansas, most of the solar projects are pretty small. There's a few that are medium-sized at the U of A, but this is definitely the largest one in this area.
And the fourth largest solar power project in the state, Warren says.
The power is fed into our local grid, and therefore it just really cuts down on our overall consumption.
The VA solar energy production won't exceed usage, so won't be sold back to SWEPCO via reverse metering, which allows alternative energy producers to sell power back to the grid. Warren says they will measure output over the next year and make any necessary adjustments. The Veterans Administration Green Management Program facilitators will also be monitoring. The Fayetteville VA was pitched the solar array project as part of the Veterans Administration's Green Management Program.
They selected campuses throughout the country. Right. An overall project to cut the energy usage throughout the nation with a goal of decreasing it by 20% by 2020.
Renewable energy projects implemented at VA facilities yield energy cost savings, reduce reliance on fossil fuels, and provide environmental benefits, including reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Joseph Sable is team member of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Green Management Programs. He's based in the central office in Washington, D.C.
So the way a site is selected for a solar installation is based on the a variety of factors, including the interest of the facility. All of the proposals are evaluated in a feasibility study to make sure it's a useful investment both from a technical perspective and from a fiscal perspective so that we get the best value for the taxpayers' dollars.
The cost of the Fayetteville VA solar system was around $1.3 million. So where does that money come from?
The VA receives a limited congressional appropriation for energy projects. And then the projects that we would like to do are prioritized based on the feasibility studies that I mentioned. And again, trying to find the best value, save as much money as possible that we can then reinvest in caring for our veterans and their families.
And the Fayetteville VA solar installation is one of dozens across the U.S., Sable says.
We have installed overall about 78 solar projects across the country. They tend to work best where there's both a lot of sun and the cost of electricity is high. The sizes of the projects range from about 100 kilowatts up to 9 megawatts in Los Angeles. West Los Angeles is our biggest facility. Fayetteville is just under 300 megawatts, and it's one of our smaller ones, but it's just as effective. And lately, we've been increasing the number of solar facilities that we've been able to install because the price of solar panels has been dropping quite dramatically in the last few years.
The VA's green program is part of a larger environmental management program to assure environmental accountability is integrated into day-to-day actions as well as long-term planning.
Green management program actually started in 2003. The first energy mandates, federal energy mandates, go back to actually 1978 in the Carter administration. And since that time, since the green management program began in 2003, our mission has been to reduce the Department of Veterans Affairs' environmental footprint by reducing energy, reducing greenhouse gases, saving money, conserving water, making a healthier environment for our veterans, their families, employees, and the communities we serve.
And the VA's green management programs cover an array of applications.
Energy conservation, vehicle fleet management, environmental compliance. We have a climate change adaptation program. And we're also responsible for environmental justice issues. But our investment in terms of infrastructure are primarily solar systems and combined heat and power projects.
Now, the U.S. Department of Defense is the single largest consumer of energy in the United States. That's according to Global Green. But it's also going green, starting in 1990 with a congressional appropriation to preserve natural resources while supporting military readiness. The DOD also conducts collaborative environmental research programs, harnessing the latest science and technology to improve environmental performance, reduce costs, and enhance and sustain mission capabilities. And the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Green Management Programs, which celebrates Earth Day annually, by the way, conveys awards to deployed projects to recognize and encourage innovation and cost savings. And it also sets benchmarks in its most recent reporting as of January 2013. The program is excelling in meeting reductions in water and energy use and expansion of renewable energy and green construction. The VA, however, is lagging in reduction of its petroleum fleet and greenhouse gas emissions. But then, aren't we all? For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more about the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Green Management Programs, visit green.va.gov. And Fayetteville VA Project Engineer Lee Warren invites the public to take a look at their new solar installation, located in the southeast parking lot adjacent to Building 4.
This week in This American Life, Danelle was in a car wreck and went into a coma with a traumatic brain injury. And when she came to, she had trouble remembering the years before her accident. Big stuff, like divorcing her husband.
The doctors said, you don't want to create any more trauma with her. And so if she's indicating that she thinks that she's still married, you can't just drop that bomb on her.
That's this week.
Sunday at 10 a.m. on 91.3 FM.
Several churches are located near the intersection of College Avenue and Dixon Street in Fayetteville. There's Fayetteville First Baptist Church, Central United Methodist Church, St. Paul's Episcopal Church, and First Christian Church Disciples of Christ. Sunday, First Christian Church will celebrate the building's 100th anniversary. Although the building is a century old, its membership dates back 166 years. The church can trace its roots to the winter of 1848 after a 12-day tent meeting held by two pastors, Robert Graham and John T. Johnson. A few years later, Graham founded Arkansas College on the grounds where the church now stands. Betty Arambell is a seventh-generation Disciples of Christ member. She says her family moved to Fayetteville in 1965 when she was just a year old, and today she is the church's historian.
You know, a lot of people look at Old Main and they think that was the first college here, and it wasn't. There was also Cane Hill College, but the Arkansas College got in one day before Cane Hill, so we take great pride in that. but that's where it was. The church was originally on the square, on the southwest corner of the square. And during the Civil War, the ministers were kind of siding with the, not that you could, whether it would have made a difference, but they were kind of siding with the North. And at some point, they had to leave the area. But somewhere during the Civil War, the church on the square was burned, and so was the college.
Following the war, a new church was constructed in 1872 on the location where Arkansas College once stood. In 1912, a faulty coal furnace caused another fire that destroyed that church. The current building was rebuilt over the course of 17 months at a cost of $25,000, and it was officially dedicated on May 24, 1914. The red brick building was designed by architect A.O. Clark, and it towers over those passing by on College Avenue. The words First Christian Church are etched into white stone over the arches on the west side of the building. Guests who park in the south parking lot can enter the building by walking past a small water feature and up a staircase to the church's office. Located immediately to your left is a door to the sanctuary, which is by far the most impressive space in the church. The room has a large open layout with rows of wooden pews descending toward the east end of the room where the choir loft, pipe organ, pulpit, and lectern are all located. The arched pews are covered with red seat cushions that match the sanctuary's red carpet.
Our pews are 100 years old, and at one point there was talk of changing those out, and a couple of guys in the church, when they started pricing them, that got real expensive quickly, and we're one of the few churches that have arched pews. That's a really, you won't find that anymore, new. So we had a couple of guys in the church, they were retired, and pew by pew they took out the pews and would move them over to the side, and had actually made tools to split the wood, re-glue, and so they re-glued them and added a little extra support underneath, and pew by pew refurnished them all. And so we hope they'll last another 100 years.
Betty estimates the sanctuary can seat 250 to 300 people. Helping the church seat more guests is an annex located on the north side of the room. The annex can be closed off from the sanctuary by closing these large, towering wooden doors. Betty estimates the four dark-colored panels that slide along a track and lock into place measure 30 feet by 40 feet. The church also has 42 stained glass windows, several of which are located in the sanctuary. No church records exist to date or identify the studio or artist who created the church's stained glass windows, but some of the larger ones are copies of popular designs used in churches around the world. A western window depicts Jesus rescuing Peter from the sea and is based on a painting by Swedish-American artist Herman Soderstrom. David Calhoun of D&S Stained Glass in Lowell provided restoration work of the windows in the late 1990s, and according to church documents, he said the glass is referred to as cat's paw. One of 13 textures of glass made at Kokomo Opalescent Glass Company in Kokomo, Indiana. A large square stained glass window is located in the center of the white vaulted ceiling, and there's actually an attic space behind it. To reach it, you must go back toward the lobby and up a set of stairs to the church's third floor. Betty says a few years ago, this space became the latest one to be remodeled.
So this whole area up here was totally gutted, and all the space was reconfigured. One of the things that is original are the wood floors. This was wood that was saved from the original flooring and put down and redone. So we now have a multimedia room that we use for Sunday school and also meetings.
The upstairs also includes a bathroom and shower area for people on mission trips who stay at the church. The hallway wraps around back toward the sanctuary, and Betty points out a small wooden door that she estimates to be 3 feet by 3 feet. She says that used to be one of the ways you could get to the space above the sanctuary. Now you can go up another flight of stairs and open a regular-sized door to an attic space that reveals the church's old wooden beams, pink insulation, and that square stained glass window you can see overhead when you're sitting in the sanctuary.
This is above the sanctuary. So, as a kid, I had a couple of friends, and we could crawl up here. And at one point, my friend went home, and she told her dad, and he goes, "Well, whatever you do, don't step on the plaster." And we were like, "Oh my, you know." So from there on, we made sure we stayed on the wood, and thank God we didn't fall through the ceiling. That would have been a mess. We'd been in trouble.
At times, the church feels like a labyrinth, with meeting rooms, classrooms, and bathrooms located in every nook and cranny. It seems as though no space goes to waste. Helping guests navigate the century-old building are maroon signs mounted on walls whose white lettering and arrows point you in the right direction. If you head back down to the office, you can take another set of stairs down to the basement. The game room is located to the west and contains white block walls decorated with blue, red, yellow, and green paint splatters. Church historian Betty Arambell notes this room's purpose has changed several times, and now it's filled with items like a foosball table and an air hockey table. If you head to the east, you'll find yourself in the fellowship hall, which is filled with tables and chairs that can be used for meetings or dinners. After moving some chairs in a corner, Betty opens a door behind them and reveals another storage closet.
So, as another story, when I was a kid, this was always the place that there was a dead possum. Who knows whether it was true or not? It kept us out of here, though.
Another interesting part of this room is you can see part of the church's brick wall, as well as old rock walls beneath it that Betty thinks may have been part of the original church's foundation. The fellowship hall leads into the kitchen, which was added in 1965 and was updated in the 80s. The two-story Christian education building was also added onto the church in 1965. A nursery is located on the first level of the Christian Ed building, and classrooms are located on both floors. While the church has about 300 participating members, Betty says lots of folks who don't attend her church are familiar with the outside of the building.
A lot of people don't know about the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, but when you tell them where the church is and you say, "Well, it's red brick, it's there by the courthouse," and they'll go, "Oh, the one with the really pretty stained glass windows." Like, "Yeah, that's it." And they go, "I've never been in there, but yeah, that's such a pretty church."
If you're interested in getting a look at the inside of this church, First Christian Church Disciples of Christ will be hosting an event to celebrate the building's 100th anniversary this Sunday. There will be one worship service at 10 a.m., which Betty says will incorporate music and scriptures that were read during the original dedication. A meal will be served after, and the cost is $10 for adults and $5 for children 12 and younger. You can RSVP by calling 442-4674. More information is available at fccfayetteville.org.
The button got its start in early political races and can be traced back to the very first presidential inauguration in 1789 for George Washington. But it wasn't until the late 1800s that today's design, with a pin back and transparent cover, was developed. Cassie Gross with K&A Button Emporium in Bella Vista now has quite the vintage button collection and says buttons go through all of the decades and are able to really capture a moment in time.
I had probably about a 20-button collection of just specialty ones that I had seen around I thought were cute or just interesting or nifty. I have one. It's a McCormick spice button from like the 60s, and it says, "I'm a pepper."
About halfway through a graphic design degree, Cassie was swamped with all of the typical college things, projects, studying, work, and had little time to work on her personal art and graphic design projects. Her then-boyfriend, Arden, suggested button making as a workable size and medium for an artist with hardly any free time.
And so my now husband came up with this great idea. He saw these button machines, and he just said, I think this would be perfect for you to just do little works on. You don't have to feel like pressure that it's a big, huge thing you're going to mess up. And he just thought it was a great canvas and medium for my work. And so he spent the money and got me the machine, and we just went from there.
She was able to utilize her graphic design skills and software to make 2-inch designs. Her first ever applied to a button, 3 cat heads in varying neon colors. She also makes mini collages from things like images from old books. She scans them and reprints them as to not hurt the book, and then arranges them in a mish-mosh-posh way. Transitioning from a larger format to the smaller one wasn't too difficult. Cassie did find it less intimidating. The only drawback was found in working with business customers.
It's different sizing things for the button. If I have a certain logo that I'm working with or things like that, I have to definitely account for the size and say, well, do you mind if it's modified a little? Or, I mean, what are your specifications for it being on the button? And usually people are just like, whatever, you know, whatever works. And that's what is really fun about it. I get to, you know, help other people and hear what their ideas are, collaborate all together. So it's a lot of fun.
She says button making is a great meeting people medium, as well as an artistic medium. K&A Button Emporium has been to various shows, such as the Little Craft Show and the Hip Handmade Market. Cassie wasn't planning on getting out her button maker at the first one due to liability questions, but then decided it would be fun to do on-the-spot button making with her customers. She has also been asked to do birthday parties where guests can color and design their own, letting their creative side show.
I know it's hard for me sometimes to think of all the different things I have going on and the artwork I want to create. And if I can help anyone do that during the day, that's great, you know. I feel like it frees people's minds when they can be a little creative every day. So it's just something very personable, and buttons seem approachable to me.
And the perfect button?
You know, the thing about buttons is they don't have to be perfect. A button can be something totally unique. You know, there's totally one-of-a-kind buttons, and there's definitely artworks that deserve to be one-of-a-kind, and buttons can be that same kind of thing. They can definitely portray someone's personality through one button, or you can have a series of buttons. I mean, they can tell a single story, or they can tell different stories.
Essentially, it can be anything the creator wants it to be, using anything they want to. The most time-consuming part of button making, she says, is the idea time, with the assembly not taking long at all. Cassie brought with her to the Carver Center for Public Radio 2 portable button machines, purchased new, though they bear a worn look from extensive use. The parts of the button are 1, 2, 3, she says. Today, we will make a KUAF logo button. Cassie has a logo printed out, and it was already a perfect circle shape, though we use a die cutter to cut it from its square page.
Okay, so then you just take your little round logo, which is, it's good when you're using your programs or whatever you're using to have a pre-cut circle, just to be able to tell where your design is. If you're hand coloring it or something, it's good to have the outline. And then you just center your logo into my little die cut. And it cuts it out perfectly. I don't have to do any guesswork. That's the nice part about that. And then a button is 3 parts. We have a metal front, a plastic. Some button machines come with a like a metal back, and it has a couple different parts. This machine we got, it's our first machine so far, and it has plastic backs. And then you also have a little clear top cover, which is called a Mylar. And then what you do is, this little handy dandy machine, is put your little metal backing into the one side, which is called the die cut side, and then you line your little image that you're putting onto the button in on top of that, and then your little clear Mylar piece goes on top of that. You switch it over to the other side like you're about to press it, and then The backing has a little squiggle side and then the side that actually punctures into your clothing to pin it to yourself. You want the squiggly side up. And then, I'm going to let you do this.
Okay.
So I want you to push and pull, push this all the way this way.
Okay.
Yep, go ahead. You might think that it's too... There you
go.
Oh,
there we go.
Now lift it up.
Okay.
You're not going to see your button yet. You're going to switch the side.
And do the same thing?
Do the exact same thing. Okay, right. Are you ready? You're going to have a button. You just made a button.
All right. Pretty easy.
Isn't it?
It is.
And it's fun, too. It's cool. Just a neat way to express yourself, for sure. And it can be a workout, too.
Cassie always wears a button somewhere on her person and will be at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville for First Thursday, June 5th, beginning at 8 p.m. Perhaps she'll have her button machine, but definitely she'll have her buttons, including a mystery button box. For $1, a customer receives a surprise button in a cute paper pouch. For more information, you can find K&A Button Emporium at facebook.com/somesweetbuttons. This is Ozarks at Large.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, the last draft of history, 9/11 enshrined in a museum.
The museum's job is both to tell the full story, but frankly, to play a productive role within all of the conversations that are literally defining this post-9/11 world.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Listen Sunday at 11 a.m. to KUAF 91.3 FM.
The Art Center of the Ozarks is holding a pre-demolition party in its warehouse located on the corner of Main Street and Meadow Avenue Friday evening. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellum spoke with organizers of the event earlier this week for a daily edition of Ozarks at Large. Here is his report.
Downtown Springdale's landscape is going to have an alteration soon. A warehouse at Main and Meadow, owned by the Art Center of the Ozarks, will be demolished so the ACO can create green space and parking for patrons. But before that warehouse goes down, there will be a wrecking ball party. Artists and musicians will combine for a one-time-only night of interactive art on the evening of May 30th. Yesterday, Tim Ferris, who is the technical director for the party, and Benjamin Del Shreve, one of the musicians scheduled to play, came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Tim says the organizers have decided to celebrate all kinds of changes for Springdale.
This building will be what they call razed or torn down at the end of the event. So it's a one-time event to celebrate the artistic community before we tear it down.
Ben, have you ever played in a place that you knew as soon as you were done was going to have the bulldozers come by?
That's a good question. I don't know that I've ever had that. I've treated stages like that was going to happen and got in trouble after the performance, but I don't think it's ever been an actual thing before. Yeah. I was thinking about that this afternoon. I was like, that is kind of a freeing thought. Like, of course, I'm playing an acoustic set this time, so I'm kind of missing out. If it was a full band thing, I guess that'd be a good time to kind of knock a hole in the wall or something like that.
Rock it, yeah.
So poor me. I'm not going to hurt my ukulele. That'd be...
No, don't do that.
That'd be cutting your nose off to spite your face.
Yeah, yes. Just like rock and roll. Yeah. They're like, no, it's not.
Yeah. Well, Tim, as technical director, I mean, and you're putting together a venue in a place that is on limited time, what's going to be in there? You have carte blanche, I suppose.
Absolutely. I mean, so the whole start of this process was to clear some of the stuff that was in the building and then create this blank canvas. And, you know, it was seemingly already that way. We just had to get the stuff out of the way. And so, you know, the artists that have come in, Matt Miller, Sasha and his brother, and Sauer, just literally had a blank canvas, which was odd for them, and it's difficult to start. From what I understand, it's like a blank page before you start your writing process. It was really blank walls and creating that blank canvas for the artists to work. Yeah. The wrecking ball, I feel like, is going to be one of those experiences because there will be so much stimulation, both artistically, musically, the food that's there, the people that will be there. All of those things will come together at one, you know, point in time.
Yeah.
And that's important.
It's kind of interesting. You know, and it's definitely a constant muse of mine, but the idea of one's finality and letting that be a muse. You know, I read in a book, I think it was actually a Christian book, Wild at Heart. Okay. It was talking about there's no man more dangerous than the man who's reckoned with his own death. And I thought that was such a powerful statement, and that's worth living by right there, you
Absolutely.
Know? But when you actually realize this may be the last time you sing this song, mm-hmm. this may be the last time you paint a picture, or, you know, for you know, the listeners out there or the people who aren't necessarily artists, how many people have you already seen for the last time?
Mm-hmm.
You may never know.
Yep.
So you should always treat it like that might be the case, and you know, love, love, love.
Brings a little bit more passion to an experience, well, doesn't it?
The truth of the matter is that you always might be at your twilight.
Yeah.
One can never know.
No.
And you never know about those that you love around you, you know. Those grudges we hold that we think are so sacred are nothing once someone passes, and we don't realize it till then, sadly.
Makes getting upset over that, not getting that parking space a little less important,
yeah.
right?
It's like, yeah. That was my parking slot.
Yeah. I'm going to pump the brakes and just keep my zen for now and just realize this is not a big deal.
But like Ben said, it's about love. I mean, that's a driving force. And love creates community and creates people coming together. Mm-hmm. That's extremely important, once again.
I don't mean any disrespect for this, what I'm about to say, Tim, but there are going to be people who hear this description. Okay, there's interactive art, there's Matt Miller, there's Benjamin Dale Shreve, there's stuff going on in Springdale.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not, for a lot of people, especially maybe people who live outside of Springdale, that's not where they go.
Right. In their mind.
Thinking. Right.
But conceptually thinking, when you look at Northwest Arkansas as a whole, it's right in the middle of everything. So if we don't isolate ourselves to one particular area, then branching to that is not that difficult, either from south or from the north. And this is the first one, the first and the last one with the ACO Wrecking Ball. But for the area as a whole, I think keep that in the back of your mind, because it in and of itself is a blank canvas. And I live, work, and play all within the area. It's extremely bohemian, if you will. It's just a much slower pace. It's a nice pace.
Part of the bill at the Wrecking Ball Party on Friday, May 30th, is Benjamin Dale Shreve playing solo. And yesterday, inside Furman Garner, he played a new song inspired by his newfound love of the mandolin and the role a local landmark played in helping him change his life.
It's a storyteller song. First verse is talking about my mom. Second verse is talking about youthful angst, you know, whenever you feel yourself kind of fighting with yourself because you just want to either conquer the world or burn it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Other part just talks about, very allegorically acknowledges my rougher time in life and how I acted. And then in finality, though, it ends me up on Mount Sequoia, where I would go, especially last summer on a regular routine, I would end up there meditating, just sitting quietly and just listening. And, you know, just saying, you know, speak to me, Lord, I'm listening. Speak through me, I'm willing,
mm-hmm.
you know. Keep my, you know, in my heart, my hands were up, just saying, you want to give me something, give it to me. You want to take it, you take it. You know, I'm at peace. Mm-hmm. And so the name of the song is Mount Sequoia.
Like a fragrance that I yet to smell. At the start of every season, we are nicer than in the center of a snowfall. We all want a summer swim like a baby. that'll only smile at me. Like maybe, oh, when you need a sure damn thing. Mount Sequoia, Mount Sequoia, Mount Sequoia, Her eyes told me she had a baby. Her body told me no such thing. She swallowed fire while I was singing. What a pair we'd make, like a circus. She'd fallen past an open window, like the sound of a football game, skipping across a quiet pond. Mount Sequoia, Mount Sequoia, Mount Sequoia, When I hear my train a-comin', I'll be getting on a plane. All my old shoes and dead flowers will expound upon my name, Mount Sequoia. Sunset in the rain, I guess I sought the shade. I sought the shade of a single tree. I guess I sought the shade. I sought the shade of a single tree.
Benjamin Dale Shreve will play an acoustic set at the Wrecking Ball Party in the soon-to-be-extinct Art Center of the Ozarks Warehouse on Friday, May 30th. The warehouse is located at the corner of Main Street and Meadow Avenue in downtown Springdale. Also scheduled to participate that night are musicians Waterwalk, Unza, Woody and Sunshine, Chris Cash, and DJ Aboriginal.
That was Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums, who filed that report earlier this week.
Louis C.K.'s comedy about divorce, parenting, work, and sex often takes his audiences to uncomfortable places.
You feel a little sweat on the back of your neck when you get there, but if you stay there for a second, you can find something joyful and funny in it.
Louis C.K. talks about the new season of his FX series Louis on the next Fresh Air weekend. Join us.
That's this Sunday evening at 6 on 91.3 FM.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, May 25th, 2014. I'm Christina Karnatz.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And with us now, Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I still think you should have done three names, and then we could just be here all day saying our names.
I know, I know.
You know, my boyfriend did, in fact, propose, but I have to fit my whole name on one byline, so I don't know how.
My name's really long. Christina Elizabeth Thomas Karnatz. It's just too long.
Yeah. I think I'm just going to stick with Becca Martin Brown. I'm used to it now. One thing I'm getting used to is walking for exercise. Mm-hmm. And I've done a 5K, although I had to walk all of it. So it was a very long 5K.
That's okay.
But there's all sorts of runs now for all kinds of good causes. And this weekend, there is perhaps the craziest one.
The color run?
No, crazier than the color run.
Oh, I don't think I know this one.
It's Monday at Veterans Memorial Park in Fayetteville, and it's a benefit for Arkansas Support Network, which helps children and adults with disabilities. They're doing a 5K, All right, cool. They're doing a 1 mile fun walk, run, roll.
There we go.
They're doing a 10K trail run, and they're doing a CrossFit run.
Oh, my.
It's called the Murph Challenge, and it is honoring Lieutenant Michael P. Murphy, who was a SEAL who died in Afghanistan in 2005. Mm. People who do CrossFit all over the country do the Murph Challenge. Mm. It includes a 1 mile run, 100 pull-ups, 200 push-ups, 300 squats, and another 1 mile run to wrap it up.
I'm out.
Yeah, me too.
100 pull-ups. I mean,
I
that's
can't
just,
even do like
no.
two.
My
no.
boss, my managing editor, does CrossFit, and oh boy. Anyway, all this starts at 7:30 Monday at Veterans Memorial Park in Fayetteville, and you can find out more at supports.org. There is also an Ozark Open Water Swim on Monday at Hickory Creek Park at Beaver Lake, a competitive swim. The Color Dash is Monday in downtown Fort Smith. There's an Everyday Superhero 5K and 1 mile walk sponsored by the Morgan Nick Foundation and Crawford County CASA on May 31st in Van Buren. And the Pig Trail Mud Run on May 31st at Ecclesia College in Springdale. And finally, the Lincoln Lake Trail Race, which is an 8K race and a 2 mile fun hike, which is clearly a definition of fun I'm still working on.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Support for KUAF comes from Vetro 1925, offering classic Italian dining with a touch of sophistication. Located just off the square in Fayetteville, Chef Dirks and his staff strive to preserve simple, bold flavors using fresh ingredients. VETRO1925.com for reservations, catering, and private party information.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Decatur.
Decatur. Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Karnatz.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Kyle Kellums will be back tomorrow for a special Memorial Day edition of Ozarks at Large.
Yes, the entire show will be highlights from a forum that he recently moderated at the Fayetteville Public Library. It featured local singer-songwriters talking about the art of songwriting. It was Barrett Baber, Candy Lee, and Sean James. So we'll have them some highlights from that, including songs that they performed during that event.
That's right. And then we'll have a more regular edition of Ozarks at Large back again on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So everybody have a great holiday. Yeah. We'll end today's show with a song from Blackberry Smoke. The Southern Rock Quintet will be at Neuermeyer's Rib Room in Fort Smith Thursday evening. That show begins at 8:15. So this is Blackberry Smoke's Six Ways to Sunday.